Welcome to Juice Podcast. I'm Emily Harmon, and today Gwen's actually away, and I'm joined by
David Cope.
David's joining us from South Africa. So, David, tell us a little bit about what you do.
So, I have a company called Public, based in Cape Town. We have a wine bar and a distribution business and an online retail side of the business, and essentially dealing with small artisan South African wine producers. Okay. And started as a bar about almost 7 years ago, just as a way to basically drink more good, interesting stuff. And it's just evolved into what it is now. And got a bar in Johannesburg as well. And essentially just anything to do with the small, good quality artisan producers in South Africa, that's where we get involved.
Yeah. And when you opened up the first wine bar, what was the wine scene like in Cape Town?
Very much dominated by the big producers and the big brands. So much so that one of the prominent local wine journalists actually said there wasn't going to, because the idea behind the bar was to pour only smaller independent producers, and they actually said we're going to run out of wines to pour because there weren't enough. And to be honest, I did have a thought, you know, there's at the time, 7 years ago, it was a very different industry. There weren't nearly as many smaller producers making their own thing. It's completely changed now, but we didn't have had a problem with it. The moment we opened the doors, word got out, and I guess one of the best things in the wine world is that everyone's very friendly and helpful to each other in terms of the producers and winemakers. And yeah, so as soon as we opened, people came and knocked on our doors and, you know, we discovered wines, and they'd pour their wine, they'd mention someone else's wine, and we'd go find that, and that kind of steamrolled, and the next thing you know, we're trying to decide which wines to pour and not pour, and at the same time, I think the industry has just exploded like the rest of the world in terms of the smaller natural producers.
I mean, that's really cool. When I was over in South Africa in November, that's the thing that really struck me about it, actually, was how strong the sense of community was between everybody working in that business. Like, I don't think I've seen that in quite the same way anywhere else in the world. Like, it's almost like people, the winemakers, particularly, like, I mean, I saw a lot in the Swartland, but then you kind of see, like, you know, the guys at Habriel's Kloof, Cristal, like, you know, Memento, like, they're all, there's like kind of collectives of people in place that are really working together and supporting each other.
I don't think there's anywhere else, I mean, I'm not sure, but I don't know of anywhere else like that in the world where essentially they're competing against each other in the market. But when it comes to farming and production, you know, you have wine makers that share a press with their neighbor, and you have winemakers that are, you know, borrowing things the whole time, and there's a lot of shared resources, and, you know,
promote
the neighbors
each other.
Totally, and they'll phone each other up and say, look, I'm having a, you know, there's something weird's happening with the fermentation, and their neighbor will, you know, offer advice, and it's just a, like you said, it's a community side of winemaking that's super friendly, and I guess also, I wouldn't say necessary, but it's an asset. It's probably what's made the South African wine industry jump a lot in the last sort of decade.
I wondered as well, I mean, this is a bit of a question, not to get too serious, is it also because of, you know, that sort of slight political climate in, like, it's a like South Africa's different to say like France, isn't it? Because of, you know, it's not always, there are areas where there are risks and it's a little bit more fragile, let's say, in some ways. Do you think that has, is that a contributing factor to why people kind of stick together and look out for each other more? Or
it's possible, possibly. Yeah. I mean, I think I guess it's a theory, but it's not really sound, but there's like a cycle of winemakers in South Africa where 20 years ago, 15 years ago, all the wines were being made by these bigger producers and more established names, and they were making very good wine, but they weren't making the most exciting wines. And they probably weren't making the most exciting wines because they were doing it mostly as a business and oriented around a certain approach. And then what happened, I guess, over the last decade and a bit longer was the younger winemakers that were working as, you know, assistant winemakers or as winemakers at these farms started dabbling on their own stuff on the side. And because it was a side project, you know, they could be a bit more experimental. They could do things a bit wackier and push the boundaries a bit. And for the producer that they're actually working for, it can be beneficial because of the stuff that they're finding out through their own experimentations. They can bring some of their knowledge into the main producer's farm, I mean, producer's wines. But ultimately what ends up happening is those side projects become bigger to the point where that winemaker goes off and does that full-time on his own.
Yes.
And if you look at all the big names in South African wine that have emerged in the last two decades, like Saadi Family Wines or Baden-Horst in the Swartland, a lot of the producers like Cristallum, other producers in Stellenbosch, they've a lot of them started by winemakers that were, you know, dabbling as side projects, and they were allowed that sort of flexibility and that kind of, you know, if you think about 50 winemakers doing that and started 50 smaller brands, and those wines are way more experimental and interesting, it's only because they could do it as a side project. If they got given, you know, the capacity to say, look, you can make whatever you want, but there's a huge amount of money behind it, investment, don't fuck it up. They're not going to do anything too crazy because they're going to be too safe. And I think that's probably been the biggest boon for the industry, is the experimentation, the trying things. And
yes,
you know, the Swartland's a hotbed for it because I think 20 years ago, the land was cheap there. So a lot of the young producers, if they wanted to go buy a piece of land, that's where they did it. It wasn't because it was, you know, better or worse than any other region. It's just attracted people and from an, I guess, a cost side. But then obviously there are some incredible vineyards, and that also obviously makes a huge difference.
I mean, the Swartland as well, just from a European perspective, particularly just based on my information or knowledge on South African wines from working in the UK. I mean, I met Craig Hawkins, which now his wines tested longer. At the time, he was at Lamazook. And that was in 2012. And I remember at that point, it was when everybody started to get very, very excited about what was going on in the Swartland. Craig was talking about the Swartland Revolution tastings that we're doing, which is now Swartland Independent Producer Tasting.
Yeah, kind of. It's evolved. What's the name of it? It's the Swartland, Swartland Independent Producers.
Yeah. And it's quite impressive to what extent those wines have been so successful. So the New Wave tasting in London last year was one of the most popular wine, like, everybody I spoke to
best
that went
to it
was
just
like,
of wine.
Oh my God, yeah, people were queuing up. There was so much excitement around it, and that's a real testament to, I think, the hard work and the work of people being a community together and how important it is to work that way.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he's also done, Craig Hawkins, you got to get him on this because he's done so incredibly well.
Craig's coming to Berlin in May, so I was going to ask him. And he did say, I don't really like doing that stuff, but I've known you for a long time, so I'll do it.
No, he'll be good. He's also, and just, you know, to go back to like the styles of wines and things, but when he was working for Lammershoek, I met him and actually did my very first sort of basically bit of, you know, cellar rat, you know, mucking about in a cellar, shoveling grapes at Lammershoek under Craig for a couple of days, more than 10 years ago. But when he started doing his Test a Longer label there, actually, I think he started before he even started at Lammershoek, but the stuff he was making back then was pretty wild. And the stuff he's making now is still wild, but since he's gone on his own and has to essentially make it work, it's a bit more controlled, and he's learned a lot over that time. And we were talking about, you know, PetNat and PetNat surprises and exploding bottles and things. And there's basically a what I'd call a great progress in the sense of, you know, his what he started out doing and the learning curve, you know, and Test the Longer and the quality of wine. And it's probably one of the best natural wine producers and wine brands in the world right now. Anyway, Craig Hawkins is a rock star, yeah.
Craig has really become a rock star. I'm really proud of him. I think he deserves it. So, yeah, hopefully he'll come on the podcast soon. Craig, if you're out there.
Emily's waiting.
Yeah. So, what have you bought today? Because you've got a selection of wines, and some of them look familiar to me, but some of them look like I've not seen them before. So, really...
So, chose a handful just to... I guess showcase some of the grapes and styles of wine that are coming out of South Africa now that a lot of them don't make it onto the shelves in shops elsewhere. So obviously if you're into smaller producers, you can go find stuff, but I find especially in Europe a lot of importers will bring wines in and they'll distribute them through to a very small network very close to where they're based. So in Germany, if they're based in Hamburg, the wines stick around there, or Berlin, possibly around here, and don't get to the other sides of the country. So a lot of the times people will see something in South Africa and then want to get it back home and they can't get it. So, but what they can always get are the big names that have big distribution and they see them everywhere. So I just thought it's nice to showcase a handful of wines that are...
Yeah, great.
Different varieties, different styles, different things.
I think it's cool, good because, I mean, like you just said, South African Chenin is... I think it has a strong identity and quite a lot of people are familiar with it. So it's nice to...
So, I mean, South African Chenin is the base of, I'd say, majority of our great white wines. It's, you know, it's huge and it's one of the best things we have, and all those old Chenin vines are amazing. But there's also other stuff.
Yeah.
So for me, it's quite exciting to look at some of that other stuff and get people to try it. So, you know, what we do at the bar, and when we started out at the bar, the whole point was to get people to try alternative varieties. So we didn't, we actually on the first night we were open, we had some Chardonnays and some Cab, and we had a couple of the things. And that's, you know, when you look, when people walk into a spot and they see a wine list and they only recognize two wines because it says Chardonnay or Merlot, that's what they ordered, and that's all we sold that night, because no one is ordering the Colombard and the Roche Levalue and that stuff, because they're like, I can't even pronounce the word. Yeah. So we realized the next day the only way to force people to drink the weird stuff is to only offer the weird stuff. So from essentially day two, we just stopped, we just cut all mainstream varieties except for a few that I have a weakness for, like Pinot Noir. But essentially no Chardonnay, no Sauvignon Blanc, no Merlot, no Cab. Okay. So I've got a bunch of wines. The first I'm going to pour you is a Muscat.
Great.
So this is made by André Brains. He makes very, very tiny amounts of wine.
And just for everybody that's tuning in, the name of the wine is City on a Hill Muscat d'Alexandrie
2018
from the Swartland.
So André is, you know, I was talking about winemakers and the evolution. So he's actually working with David Sardi at David and Nadia. Mm-hmm. And this is his side project. So, and it's called City on a Hill. It started out as a white blend, and then you introduced the Muscat. And for me, what's great about this is there's a lot of Muscat planted around the Cape, and obviously predominantly used for dessert wine. In South Africa, this, you know, the nickname for it is Hanaput. And so, you know, I grew up, my mom would have a little glass of Hanaput every evening in winter just to like ward off the cold. But it's obviously like horrendously sticky, sweet stuff. And 300 grams of sugar and just intense. But Muscat makes amazing dry white. And what I find is phenomenal with it is, I mean, this one, like a lot of Muscat's going to have that sort of lychee freshness, that sort of character. But this one for me has got a bit more mineral, a bit more weight on it.
Yeah, definitely on the nose as well. It's quite restrained for Muscat. Like, I mean, you can see that it's got those sort of floral aromatic edges there on the nose.
But it's not.
And a bit of it's just going into this slight touch of exotic fruit, like this papaya or something, pawpaw, that it's just drifting.
And there's a, for me, Muscat's great in the sense that this one, not as much as a lot of other ones that I've tried recently, where, but it's basically that sort of paradox between a slightly sweet, intensely floral nose, but then, you know, it's super dry on the palate, and it's got that sort of weight on the palate that, you know, for people that are not expecting that and they see the word Muscat in the label, they automatically assume sweetness, and they get a little bit of that in the nose, but then when it comes to the palate, it surprises them. And that's a super fun thing for me to give to pour with people or to share with people, which I think is super interesting.
This is the thing that I like about this as well, is that there's quite a nice texture on the wine, because sometimes with Muscat you can really struggle with like if for dry Muscat it can sometimes be a little bit bitter, but there isn't this. It's actually very nice.
And I'm not 100% sure of every step on the winemaking, but I'm pretty sure this is fermented in old barrels and just left for probably about six months or even a year. And that's probably where a lot of that texture is coming from.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, very good. And so, I mean, do you know how many bottles? No, that's just too geeky to ask.
Numbers and bottles are not my forte, but I think he probably exports, like a lot of these smaller producers exports probably about half his stock. It's possible, you know, only a couple of barrels made of these wines, and that's what keeps it exciting as well, is because there's such small production, they really can play around a lot.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like if something goes wrong, it's half their revenue and supply gone down the drain. So that flexibility, I think, is quite key.
What do you think about food pairing for this?
For me, I probably look towards something with seafood. I'd probably say some sort of charred scallop or prawn or that sort of thing, something with a bit of fruit and a bit of spice in it, almost Thai style, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I was even thinking, so when I was in South Africa, I went to Paternoster and I had this prawn, kind of like lightly fragrant Indian kind of coconutty curry sort of style thing, but not too spicy. That would be very nice with this.
I say prawn, but I can't eat prawns because I'm allergic, but it somehow comes into my head anyway.
Have you ever eaten one?
Yeah, no, I used to be able to eat them, but I just...
As you got older?
I got to a point and I just said no, and, you know, that was that. No more prawns. So other seafood. I can eat mollusks and those things, so scallops will do for me.
I think I might have had prawns when we were at that Chapman's Peak, and I think Tor did as well, and then you didn't, that's why.
Yeah.
Okay.
Choose life.
Yeah.
Choose no prawns
for me. It's very poignant right now. Choose life.
Sure. And then the next wine I'm obviously horrendously biased on because I made it myself.
Oh, did you? Oh, but we tasted this, didn't we?
We tasted this in
South Africa together.
Yeah.
Yeah, great.
So this is a field blend. So that's the only reason I made this wine was I made a Grenache about 4 years ago. And the Grenache was just a once-off. I figured it was super fun, just, you know, getting my hands dirty, making the wine. I'm not a winemaker, not trained in any way, but making the wine is a lot of fun. And 2 years later, I wanted to make it again and connected through a good friend, Tremaine Smith, who's the Blacksmith Wines. And, you know, I found myself in the back of a bucky driving around an old Grenache vineyard in Darling with him and a viticulturist. And somehow the words field Yaku. Blend. Yaku, yeah. Yeah, rockstar viticulturist. And so Yaku mentioned a field blend vineyard and I just, you know, my ears popped and I was like, if there's any chance of getting some fruit, field blends are super rare. I think probably everywhere in the world, but in South Africa particularly, there's hardly any field blends. Which for me is, the idea of a field blend is such a great, you know, concept. There's got, you know, the vineyard that's got all these different types of varieties all planted together. And this is 13 different varieties all interplanted in one big vineyard in the Paardeberg. And so there's a bit of Chenin, there's, I'm not going to remember them all, but it's Semillon Gris, Palomino, there's Sauvignon, there's Chardonnay, there's Crucian Blanc, there's Colombard, there's, what have I missed out? There's a lot, there's Muscat. And so what makes it so interesting is all those different characters in one wine, but not blended afterwards, but, you know, from the actual vineyard into the tank, I mean, into the press, into the tank fermenting together, and the characters of all of them come out in different ways, and it's slightly schizophrenic almost. Every time you take a sip, you get something slightly different, and that's what makes, for me, the field blend special.
This is delicious. I mean, I know that you're just tasting it now, but I've just already had some. It's really interesting, actually, on the nose, because it's got this kind of, like, pear skin quality on the nose
and pithy. I just smelt it now and it's got quite a strong green olive sort of martini character almost.
Yeah, a right dirty now. Martini.
Yeah, but it changes. That's the thing for me. It completely changes. I mean, I guess all wine changes with the temperature, but for me, field blends, they got more capacity to change because they got more inherent variety of, you know, I guess flavor notes.
Yeah, lovely texture on that wine as well. I know what you mean about that. I think it's almost like the fattiness of olive brine as well, because olive brine's not just, it's not like vinegar, right? There's like a fatty, oily edge to it as well.
It's basically like a dirty, like you said, it's a dirty martini wine.
Yeah, sounds great, doesn't it? I'm a massive martini fan.
You could drink a bottle though, but if you drank a bottle of dirty martini, you'd probably feel slightly worse for wear the next day.
Yeah, I might not be able to get home. No. What about martinis in South Africa? Do people get into the old martinis over there?
There's definitely a resurrection of the classic cocktails. So,
that's, martinis. I mean, they're classic for a reason.
Negronis,
Audrey Hepburn, you know,
old
she
fashions.
Never gets uglier.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think also we were what I'd call in the cocktail doldrums for many years. So if you ordered a daiquiri, it basically came in out of a blender, frozen, you know, with strawberries and a little umbrella. Frozen daiquiris. We're coming off a very low base of quality cocktails. So the last sort of, I don't know, 5-10 years has been very good in the resurrection of the classic cocktail. So yeah, you can get a good martini now in Cape Town and Joburg or wherever you are.
And Negronis, I guess.
And a good Negroni.
Yeah. And the G&Ts are a big thing as well, right? G&Ts on the
street. G&Ts are huge. I mean, when we started the bar, we only served wine and we had one beer. That was it. And we had a brandy. That was the only drinks options. And then I love a Negroni, so we started adding a Negroni. And then gin and tonic, one loves gin and tonic. And then, you know, giving people a few more choices and beers. But yeah, so those are pretty much all we offer still at the moment. But if you've got a Negroni and you've got a gin and tonic and you've got wine, you've got beer, you've pretty much got everything you need.
Yeah, exactly. I'm with you. The only thing I would say, I do have a little bit of a soft spot for pina coladas. I like that you
there's a song that like, just there's a song that pops into your head when you say that word,
which apparently is like a bit of a fucked up song actually, the meaning behind that song, so it's meant to be a bit weird, but yeah, no, I love a pina colada. I'm instantly transported on holiday, so if I need to really give myself a little cheer up, I go out for a pina colada.
But would you go for a pina colada when it's cold? Or would you have to do it in summertime? Because it seems like a strange...
I mean, I think it's... You'd smash more of them in the summer, but... If the occasion was right and it felt good, I'd go for it. Because they're just delicious.
There's a similar cocktail to a pina colada, which they make in the Caribbean, British West Indies, that sort of area. And it's called a painkiller. And they basically grate nutmeg over the finished, similar mix of things and rum and stuff. But it's called a painkiller, and it's also perfectly acceptable to drink it in the morning, apparently, when you're there.
I mean, isn't that what holiday... I mean, life on the beach is about just consuming alcohol from the minute you wake up.
You can't do it every day in a row because the hangover is brutal.
From a painkiller?
Yeah.
Why is it called ironic? So it's more like a pain inducer.
Yeah.
It's just like, sorry, you've got the name wrong.
It's like a lot of alcohol, I guess.
I guess it depends how many you drink as well, right?
Definitely, yeah.
What about you?
And what you drink.
Come on, what's your little... You must have a little cocktail that you just... You're a little bit embarrassed about, but you do like it. And you don't want, like...
You mean like a cure? Like a hangover cure?
No, like... Do you mean like a cocktail? Cosmos? Like, have you got a little cocktail confession?
Sure. I don't dapple much beyond a Negroni, to be honest. I'm trying to think, yeah. I mean...
He's just being protective.
I honestly
himself.
Don't. I wouldn't.
I mean,
I don't have actually, a pina colada story about myself, unfortunately. No.
I think Public Wine Bar, Cape Town, perfect drink they should be offering. Pina colada aperitivo.
We can definitely do a
pina colada party.
I think we can do a pina colada pop-up because we love doing pop-ups with different chefs and themes. So we can definitely do a pina colada pop-up. We did a Sicilian pop-up. So now we just need to do like a Caribbean pop-up or Miami, like that.
Do some jerk chicken. If you do Miami, you've got to do Froze.
We've done Froze.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, Froze is good.
Froze is a fun time.
I like the Miami one. Everyone has to wear Hawaiian shirts, like Don Johnson vibes. And
Miami pina coladas. Will Smith's video.
Bad sunglasses.
Silk shirts.
Yeah, be quite funny.
I think he's wearing a pink silk shirt and white trousers in that music video, Miami. And he's like on the speedboat.
Oh, my God. That's like days of watching MTV.
I know, have you watched... It's so funny because I was looking at Katy Perry's new music video and she's like... And I quite like it. I'm not into her music, except if there's like a comedic opportunity to use her music. But I saw the last one and she's sort of sitting on this... I don't know what she's sitting on, but she's basically on a mountain of flowers and the flowers are like forming her dress. And she's singing about getting married or whatever. And I'm just like... Oh. Used to be much cooler music videos.
That was the MTV back in the early 2000s. That's when it was good.
Yeah.
Back when I was supposed to be at university.
Even the 90s, like we used to have a show Top Pops as well.
I remember Top of the Pops. I watched that.
Yeah. Did you have that? Did you have your own version or was it the UK?
No, the UK one. Yeah.
But it was. I mean, that was amazing. Like, and you just see like.
But then they just performed live. It was only like,
yeah, but like then you'd find out who's number one. Like that's what you want to do. So
it was
like,
it was the reveal.
Nirvana's coming in, performing stuff. It was brilliant. Top of the Pops.
Nirvana played Top of the Pops.
Yeah, but he never got invited. Kurt Cobain never got invited back because he was so sarcastic when he did it. So he was just like,
Because it's mime. I mean, he could have been. Mime. That's why. Yeah. They don't actually sing. Don't they? Something like that?
I don't know if it was mime, but it was either that he was really wrecked or I think it was a little bit like a fuck you.
Yeah.
Top of the Pops thing going on.
I remember something about that.
Yeah.
Funny.
What have we got next? That wine's delicious. I almost could have a bit more of that. That's so tasty.
You can have a bit more of that if you
want.
Do it.
Yeah, I will.
It's going to take me at least 10 seconds to open this next.
That's like two glasses of wine.
This next bottle.
So, and just to be clear, so the wine that we've just tasted with David here, so this is, it's called Full Moon White 2018. And is Full Moon the name of the winery?
Well,
but is that your brand name?
I mean, winery is a big, that's the name of the brand. There's no big, beautiful, biodynamic, full moon harvest story behind it. It's actually more inspired by a personal connection to the cellar where we actually make the wine. It's the cellar that we got married at and there was a full moon. And so
that's
more
so
of a personal
nice.
Story than a farming story. But people generally ask if it's a full moon because it's harvested at full moon. And it sounds nice, but not actually the truth. No. Just full moon in name. Okay, so.
I mean, there's many. Oh, very nice.
I don't know if you've had any Raised by Wolves wines before?
I had one bottle of one of their wines, and I feel like it was a Semillon, but it was
not skin contact like this.
No, it wasn't the skin contact.
So this is one of my favorite things in South African wine, is like the little anecdotes and the names of wines and grapes. So Semillon in Afrikaans is Groendruif, which is green grape. And then Semillon Gris, because it's obviously got the gris, it's the red colored fruit, it's known as Rooigroendruif, which is red green grape. So this is Rooigroendruif Semillon. It's basically Semillon red green grape. It's that mutation in the vineyard that's harvested separately and pressed, and obviously gets a little bit of color from a little bit of skin contact. And so it's this delightful, slightly pink, rusty color.
It's almost like sort of this sort of burnt orange, rusty, yeah. But I mean, it looks like an orange wine, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a bit of skin contact in here. I mean, it's definitely, I want to call it part of this sort of natural new wave style. This is Raised by Wolves Semillon La Colline 2017, but the Rooigroendruif version.
Okay. And the only way to distinguish the two is by that sticker at the top, right?
Little red sticker on the top of the bottle. Okay. And in South Africa, there's obviously, like most countries, there's a sort of controlling body for the wine industry, and they don't actually officially recognize this as a separate grape. So the Semillon is the grape, whether it's Groendruif or Rooigroendruif, the green or the red grape, it's just Semillon on the books. So technically this is like an unofficial designation, but it's Semillon. But yeah, compared to his other Semillon, which is just, you know, the normal green grapes, it's a completely different wine. Texture, smell, aromatic, like everything, it's just a whole different world. And one of my favorite wines in South Africa, so Adam Mason is the winemaker, and again, side project, he's the winemaker for a big seller that produces good, you know, big volumes, good quality wine, exports tons of it around the world. And then this is his little side project to get his hands dirty in the cellar and make small barrels of this and barrels of that. And I think over the years he's discovered different vineyards around the Cape that he wanted to work with, and one of them was the Semillon Gris vineyard. And yeah, makes for an exceptional wine.
Yeah, nice. So I took just the normal Semillon. I mean, I shouldn't say normal, but they're just Semillon Blanc. And I bought that at the wine shop at Chapman's Peak Hotel. And I drank it like 2 weeks after I got back from South Africa, and I was like, every sip, it was so delicious, I wanted to down. You know when you get those wines where you're like, satisfying, like the Thorn and Daughters, I find a bit like that opulence, I kind of like it. And I don't think his style's quite as textured as that, but it was so delicious, the wine. I was like, oh man, I can't get any more of this.
But isn't that the best like quality in a wine? Is where it's something that just makes you want to, you know, for me, it's like food. If you're eating food, and it's making you hungrier because it's so delicious. It's like the same thing with wine. If you're drinking a wine and it makes you thirsty to drink more because the wine's so good, it excites you. For me, that's the best quality a wine can have. And you know, obviously there's variations on textures and character and balance and stuff, but when you just want to drink more of it while you're drinking it, that's, I guess, the ultimate compliment for a wine. But this wine is... Most of his wines are what I'd say are some of the most interesting wines and super well-made. You know, they're very much what I call alternative. So Rooigroendruif Semillon, he makes a dry Muscat as well. He makes a Cinsault Cab blend. He's making slight skin contact, barrel edge Sauvignon. So he's really like pushing it out there with different styles of wines, but they're all made so well that they don't taste overly funky. They just taste really interesting.
No, this is this is great. This would be a great wine to get people interested in orange wine, because the tannins are really balanced by that texture and that fruit component in this, so it doesn't feel abrasive or too firm on the tannin side in some way to me.
For me, there's always this thing of like any wine, you look at it from there's drinkability and there's interest, and you kind of want it like, if you're way too interesting, you can't, it's not drinkable, you know. There's a lot of wines like that are great to taste, but you don't want to drink a glass. And then there's the wines that are just drinkable, they're not interesting, like commercial crap basically, that's just, you know, there's no real like character. But being in the middle road, in the middle of between sort of drinkable and interesting stuff like this, where it's got super interesting character, but it's very drinkable. Someone that's properly into their wine and wants to try experimental stuff would love it and geek out on it, and someone that just wants to have a nice glass of wine could still appreciate it too. So,
and just to go into this, La Colline is the name of the vineyard, right, which is also where Chris Alhite gets his Semillon from.
Yep, there's a bunch. Bunch of winemakers getting fruit from the same vineyard.
Yeah.
Very famous vineyard in Franschhoek.
Yeah.
And I mean that field blend that you know we tasted beforehand. There's also a bunch of winemakers that get fruit from there. I think it's when there's big vineyards and there's good fruit and you know people find out about it and you know share information and people want to get hold of some of it and most of the winemakers won't take all of it. So yeah, it's, I guess when there's a good quality vineyard, the good winemakers will find out about it and get involved. So yeah, Lacaline's pretty famous.
This is such an interesting wine, really. I keep going back to it every time you're chatting away on.
Got quite like a tea-like character.
Yeah, I was thinking like that almost like this. It's almost got like this sort of like, I won't say resin, but this sort of like freshly rolled tobacco.
Mm.
But like I know what you mean, like this tea leaf.
It's a very strong for me. We drink obviously a rooibos, red bush. I don't know what the translation is. Tea in South Africa.
Rooibos, yeah.
But there's quite a strong rooibos character in there. Obviously the tannin as well. It's nice, a bit more tannin than the other Semillon he makes. It's a phenomenal wine.
Has anybody ever done a South African approach on the old Retsina and put some rooibos into their wine?
Someone has done that.
Have they? Was it?
I didn't try.
I like that there was a slightly judgy tone to your response.
No, not at all. I'm all for experimentation with grapes. Yeah. No, I don't. It's definitely happened. People are playing around with stuff, but for me, the moment you're doing that, it's not a wine anymore. It's not a cocktail. Because you're throwing in some rooibos, maybe throwing a bit of vodka. You know, next thing you know, you're halfway to a pina colada. It's like, I think it's just a different world. I think it's fine. It's great. You know, if it's a product and it gets people to drink wine at the end of the day, then it's a win. And ultimately, that's the way I look at it. But for myself, I'm not really interested in drinking tea-infused wines.
No, I just thought went into my mind. I know Ardy's growing some rooibos on his farm. That was very entertaining when I went to see him.
I think Artie's growing a bit of everything.
I know, there's all the caper production going down, caper flowers, like saw him salting them. Like that guy is plugged into so much stuff.
Smoking agave plants to make mezcal type, you know, he's just, there's like, always something
I'm
happening.
I'm making mezcal, vermouth and wine, and I've decided that I've still got a lot more time on my hands.
He's so crushed it with the wine. It's like, you know, Bardenhorst has done so well that I think he's got some time to play around with other things.
Yeah, and do you know, I think I'd be the same. I think I'd be like, why not just do something else?
No, he's an innovator. That's what he does. Makes sense. I mean, he's a force of nature. Okay, should we try a light red?
Mm.
So I brought what I'd call Pinotage 2.0.
So, Pinotage 2.0. So what do you mean by Pinotage 2.0?
So, I guess classic style of Pinotage in South Africa would be a heavier style of red.
Mm-hmm.
If you just picked up a bottle of Pinotage off the shelf 5 years ago, 10 years ago, you're going to be expecting a full-bodied red, a lot of tannin, a lot of fruit, probably a high alcohol. And I think that's just generally how it was made, like most South African red wines. And it doesn't necessarily make sense when you think of Pinotage is a blend of, or not a blend, it's a hybrid created from two more lighter weight grapes.
Mm.
So it's essentially Cinsault and Pinot Noir. To make a heavy style out of that doesn't necessarily make sense in my view. And there are some that do actually do it very well, but there are a lot that didn't and got a bit of bad publicity for the grape. And
I mean, there was always that thing when I remember when I did my first WSET course, I think it was in like 2009 or 2010, and they were like, well, if you get a Pinotage on your blind wine tasting, it smells like black bin bags.
Black bin bags,
you know, like plastic
black tar roads.
Yeah, and it was just like, all right, well, that sounds like shit.
Easy one to spot.
Yeah, but I mean, they also never give you that on the blind tasting. But
I can get. I mean, that's the reality. Is like, I think a lot of Pinotages made historically did have that. They weren't.
Yeah.
I think, and it's a difficult grape to grow. I mean, you think about, if you look at it on a negative way, you're going to have all the bad characteristics of Pinot Noir, like tricky and hard to farm and, you know, virus, you know, that sort of stuff. And then you got the bad characteristics of Cinsault, which would probably say a little bit thin, you know, in character, I don't know, a little bit coarse. So you could look at it that way and you put all the bad characteristics of them into one wine, it's not going to sound very good. But if you look at something like this, you got all the good characteristics of it. You got all the fruitiness from Pinot, you got the cherry flavor, you got like a nice bit of clove. You got all the good character from Cinsault, where, you know, there's again a nice softness of fruit. There's what I call like a really crunchy, like easy tannin, and it makes for an amazing wine. I think this is, for me, a style of Pinotage that people can get excited about. You know, if you like Pinot, if you like Cinsault, if you like Gamay, it's that style of wine. So for me, I'd love to see more of these. And there are, thankfully, quite a few more of these style of Pinotages coming onto the market. This one is made by a winemaker named Jacques Leclerc, who's, again, side project.
So Jacques Leclerc, is that the winery name if people are trying to find the wine? Like, what would be the
Reverie
name?
So Reverie is his label. So it's just the Pinotage, and he does a Chenin Blanc as well.
2019.
So just released a few months ago. And, yeah, this is the second vintage of Pinotage he's done. And for me, this is a great model for how Pinotage can work. So a bit of carbonic maceration during winemaking, which essentially just allows the sort of brighter, super light cherry flavors to come out of the grapes into the wine. Just very drinkable.
What's nice for me about this is that there's not too much carbonic as well, because I also noticed that when I was in South Africa, sometimes there was Pinotage where it's so carbo that you just got all these, you know, it's the same with, like, you use the comparison of Beaujolais when we're talking about it. So
yeah.
I think that's the same for Gamay. Like, it's nice to have a little bit of whole cluster, so you get that intercellular fermentation or whatever. So you're getting these lovely preserved, bright fruit and floral notes or whatever. But not overdoing it, because otherwise it's too bubblegummy. But what's really nice about this is you've got that, but then you've got a nice... There's still enough fruit and a little bit of density to the fruit that it doesn't just sort of feel like it's high-toned and thin.
I mean, for me, it's like just going down that road of talking about carbonic and using it as a means to adjust the flavor profile of a wine rather than identify it as a carbonic wine. For me, it's such a interesting way to talk about wine. And, you know, how I think from the layman's perspective, when people look at a bottle of wine, they go, oh, it's Pinotage. This is what Pinotage tastes like. And then, you know, if it's a blend, oh, this is what a Bordeaux style blend tastes like. But the amount of things that a winemaker can do that are completely natural, letting the wine do its thing, but just guiding it in different ways. And, you know, that'll change the character and make it something that's completely different to a wine from the same variety, like carbonic, like skin contact with whites, you know, and like, when they're using those as, I guess, tools to add character to the wine, rather than just to become the identifiable part of the wine. I think it's such a great thing. You know, it's not about this being a carbonic Pinotage. It's about being a light, fresh, easy drinking red that, you know, the winemaker made from Pinotage and used carbonic maceration to help create that wine, which I think is great.
This would fit into my smashable wine category.
This is very smashable.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is also one of those, as you're drinking it, you want to drink more.
Yeah.
100%. Nice and chilled out the fridge. It could be a bit cold, actually. But, yeah.
I quite like it at this temperature, but you're right, it could be a bit chilled. It's 12.5% alcohol. I've just looked at the back of the label as well. No, but I like it because
beautiful. Because
what's nice about this is you've got that carbonic lift, but then you've kind of got this slightly flashy fruit about it as well.
Also, like, I mean, for me, I get a lot of clove on the nose and up front, and that sort of spicy character, which I think is also gives it a slightly different character to if it was just a Cinsault or a Pinotage or something. I mean, a Pinot Noir or something else. Or Gamay, I don't normally get that sort of character on Gamay. Yeah, very nice wine.
Yum.
And again, like I was saying, side project. So he's the winemaker at another cellar at Radford Dale.
Yeah.
Also a very good producer. We're going to try one of their wines next. But this is his side project. So it allows him to experiment, make things like this. And then obviously some of that knowledge transfers across to his work at Radford Dale.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Where he's also a partner in that. So it's I think that what I call like the exponential expansion of labels and production in South Africa that's happened over the last 5 years, these types of things is just, that's why the quality of wine's gone up so much.
The creativity, the level of creativity and expression is really exciting.
And it's easy. I mean, not easy in the sense that anyone can do it, but easy in the sense that if a winemaker decides that, if an assistant winemaker at a winery, and I know winemakers are doing this, they might be 21 years old, 23 years old, and they're in their second year making wine at harvest, you know, full-time employed, decides they want to make a barrel of something, they can do it. and they can get it out there, and they can use social media to connect it out to the market, and they can get it done and sell it. So it's the market is so accessible for winemakers making wine now that it makes sense that there are so many more options out there. But that just obviously wasn't the case 20 years ago.
Mm.
But the quality of wine is better for it, so I think it's great.
No, it's a really exciting time. Very, very exciting time for wine. Nice.
Okay.
Okay.
So Gamay, we mentioned. So
this is Gamay.
This is Gamay from
South Africa. I didn't know that there was Gamay in South Africa.
So Radfordale is the only producer that makes Gamay in South Africa.
They plant that themselves?
They have planted some themselves, and then I think they have a lease or a long-term lease on the only other Gamay vineyards that exist.
Oh, they're turning into the Gamay mafia.
The Gamay mafia. All 600 bottles.
It's like the avocado mafia. Yeah. It's like, I'm taking all the resources.
Yeah, I mean, literally, they own Gamay in South Africa. And they have planted, like I said, they've planted it quite a bit now. So they are planning to grow it as a product.
So we've got Radfordale, the Antidote, Gamay Noir 2018 from Stellenbosch.
So, Gamay, I guess a lot of people would just think of Beaujolais and then naturally maybe think of Beaujolais Nouveau, and Gamay being this shitty, thin, you know, party wine. And anyone that's drunk good Morgon wines would know Gamay as being, you know, slightly more serious, you know, something that can rival Pinot Noir.
I think Beaujolais is the last discovered fine wine region of France.
There you go.
It took a while for people to catch up, but it's...
You and Alex Dale would get on well with that perspective.
I know, I didn't get to see him. We had an email exchange. I didn't get to see him. Tour was like, oh, candid itinerary so tight when we were in South Africa. And I was like, 2 weeks was not enough, actually. I'm really excited to go back and
No, you got to visit next time. I mean, I just think the fact that he's got an understanding of, and he'd obviously lived in France for a while, and he's got a very strong connection there, and he imports a lot of French wines into South Africa. And I think the fact that he can basically take Gamay and say, I'm going to make a proper thing out of this in South Africa. And he's done it. I mean, this wine for me is, you know, he's got another wine called Thirst, which is a more fun, fresh style Gamay, very light and juicy, fruity. And then he's got this, which is his more serious style of Gamay, which I think is phenomenal as a wine. And like in terms of what Gamay can do in South Africa, I think it's great. And they're also very much, they're not a huge producer of wine, but they like to experiment with different things. So they've done Skin Contact, Claret Blanche, Whites. They've done the Gamay. They do a super light carbonic style. Cinsault. They do no sulfur added wines. They do, they play around with a lot of things. But generally the quality is up there on everything. It makes them a really good, reliable brand, I guess, in terms of the smaller natural producers in South Africa to look for. So I always like working with their wines.
This is really interesting. I mean, I like that. This is a wine as well that I think would be interesting for people, you know, with that hook of what you mentioned about discovering a great variety that you wouldn't try before. So sort of going off the beaten path, if you like, for South African wine. But it has a very sort of classic approach to the winemaking as well. So it's not a wine that would be sort of intimidating to a lot of people. It's accessible.
It's just like what we were drinking earlier. It's something that's completely out there and wacky if you talk about it. But then if you just pour it for someone and give them here's a glass of light red, they'll drink it. It's delicious. There's nothing wacky or weird about it, you know, other than it's the only one of two Gamays made in the country. But I also think it's a great reflection of what... I mean, that's same with the Pinotage and the Muscat and the Semillon Gris, is just a reflection of what else is out there in terms of interesting grape varieties and styles of wine being made outside of the norm and the big brands, and, you know, just very exciting stuff.
I like that a lot. Nice little... I mean, Gamay never has a lot of tannin, but there are obviously some tannins there, but they're so fine. It's a really... I think it's a very correct wine. It's got...
It's classic, like
fruit,
you said.
Lovely fruit, but like that kind of lead pencil thing that you sometimes see with like cooler climate Pinot. Touch of herbal edge. So again, it's like... It's there's a lot of integrity to that wine. I like it a lot. Glad to try that.
So... Alex actually imports the Foyard, Morgon, Cote de Pie, Cuvée Corselette, those wines. So he's a big, big Gamay lover. And actually, the only reason I've started to appreciate Gamay is through those wines that he brings into South Africa. But they are phenomenal. And I guess I also can't afford to drink Burgundy all the time. So
yeah.
Drinking Beaujolais is a great alternative.
You can have the top Beaujolais wines for the price of Village.
Yeah.
Village Bourgogne. Like, it's really difficult.
And they're incredible.
Yeah.
They're just not as historically sexy as...
This is what's so interesting about the natural wine movement, is that we're kind of redefining what is good wine. What are these regions? Like, what is fine wine? What does that mean? And just because of its other, it doesn't mean that it's lesser.
Well, yeah, fine wine is basically... I mean, I always this thing, it's like the never-ending cycle. Fine wine is the wines that were planted in France whatever many hundred years ago, and they were bought by the British, and then everyone else started planting them elsewhere because that's what was being sold, and people were buying it, and then because people were buying it, people were planting it, and that's what happened everywhere. So the people came to South Africa and, you know, from Europe and planted grapes. Obviously, they planted the same stuff that was being grown in France at the time. So yeah. Everywhere, Cab, Merlot, Shiraz, Sauvignon, Chardonnay, that's what they planted. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's better than a Certico or Tempranillo or other interesting grapes from, you know, other kind of Verdeo, like, but those wines just didn't get planted. And I think that's the consumer cycle. Everyone's buying the same stuff because it's fine wine. It's just actually historically that, and it's popular, but there's so much more interesting stuff out there. If people can expand their horizons and know what they're looking for, but obviously it's harder.
But those key regions as well also instilled like knowledge into producers as well. So there'd be, we know much more about Pinot Noir than we do, say, a Certico, for example, just because of
the breadth of where it's... It's Greek.
Yes, that's the point.
Sun-resistant.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a skin contact weird Certico to take back with you.
Nice.
That will not be...
Sounds delicious.
Yeah, it is very delicious. But it won't be probably a reference point for the grape, but it'll be an experience.
There's actually some producers that have planted a Certico in South Africa.
I know. I tried Evans...
Which I think is fun. I think the more interesting things that they can plant and try, see what works. And
I mean, it's smart because the climate is very suited. Like, it's similar, like, drought, drought
is... It's not getting any colder.
Yeah. Or wetter,
yeah. So it makes sense. I mean, those traditional French grapes don't... Well, not all of them, of course, but a lot of them do not do very well in some places like the Swartland where it's crazy hot. I mean, some survive, different clones and things, but, yeah. The Portuguese grapes are doing really well there. Do you want to try Pinot?
Yeah, definitely. I know, mainly because I know Cristallum. Yes.
Yeah, so Cristallum is Peter Allen Finlayson, arguably the...
One of the tallest men in wine in South Africa. He's very tall, isn't he?
Arguably one of the tallest men in South Africa. That's exactly what I was going to say.
I knew it.
There's a lot of tall men in South Africa.
Is there?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Old mate who makes the Chenin. Oh, I mean.
I don't know who you're talking about because there's so many
blonde
tall
hair,
people.
Looks like he could be a Viking.
Donovan Rawl?
Yes.
Yeah, tall.
He's so tall.
Mm-hmm.
Even David Saadi. Yeah, he's very tall. That's true.
There's tall. There's just lots of tall South African winemakers. But
I can't think of any others, but I'm sure there's more.
There's more.
It's like a rugby team.
Yeah, Lucas van Lochrenberg.
Okay.
I mean, we could probably put a full rugby team together.
Yeah, I mean...
Definitely a few packs of forwards. There's not many wingers out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craig.
But Craig could be a fly-off.
Craig's not that tall. No, he's... I don't know. He feels like he's taller than he was.
I don't know. Not compared to Peter Allen, though.
No, Peter Allen's very tall. No, anyway, so Peter Allen.
So he's... I mean, he's... I think Cristallum has been out there for just over 10 years, and he's already one of the top Pinot Noir producers in the country, so that's pretty phenomenal.
And what I love about him is he didn't even study winemaking; like, he learned.
He studied philosophy.
Yeah, and he makes like, it's funny because then you look at other people who have, like, Stompy's been to a viticultural school, right? And he's like, I mean, it comes down to a personality
to a viticultural school. I mean, but it looks like he studied philosophy, whereas Peter Allen studied philosophy, but it kind of looks like he went to viticulture school.
Yeah, because their approach is very different. But anyway, not to take away from anyone else, but what I like about Peter Allen and the wines that he makes, there is precision and detail and just this drinkability through that as well. There's a lovely harmony in his wines.
I mean, for me, that's exactly what you're saying. That for me, these are exciting wines, but they're also extremely classic. There's nothing quirky or weird or odd or different, but they're not boring in any way. They're
exciting wines,
and they're amazing. And I also think that what he's done very well is his sort of approach to working with different areas for Pinot and different vineyard sites and doing smaller single vineyard bottlings and whole bunch bottlings and that sort of thing is a very good approach, just to give people a different perspective on what Pinot tastes like from different areas. All made in exactly the same way, generally, but, you know, showing different character because of where they're from.
And so we're tasting now, just so everybody, because they can hear us pouring, so we've got the 2018...
Mabalel
Pinot Noir from Cristallum.
Yeah, so Mabalel is the vineyard.
Out of the Swartland, right? So we are...
Yeah, so Pinot Noir in the Swartland, in the Swartland would be frowned upon.
Yes, it's so hot.
It would probably make some good raisins, but... This is
everyone needs to make Pinot Noir Pasito in the Swartland.
Yeah, basically it would work.
You know, just predicting the next trend.
could anything is possible. So Mabalel is the vineyard. What's the name? It's named for the vineyard, which is in the mountains above Villiersdorp. So pretty nowhere, you know, area. But it's called Kaimanshut. But it's basically these high vineyards up in the mountains, you know, above Villiersdorp. Very cold.
So we're near Bot Rivière here? Is it near there?
We are kind of in that direction, yeah, a little bit more inland. A little bit more higher. And yeah, during harvest time, this stuff is getting harvested probably a month and a half to 2 months after a lot of other areas. And obviously Pinot Noir loves a cooler climate. So Elgin, the Himalayan Arda, and this location make for good Pinot. Slow ripening, very, very clean.
Delicious. What a wine.
And again, you talk about winemakers that embrace different techniques during the winemaking process, but there's obviously quite a bit of whole bunch, you know, fermentation happening here, and you can taste it, but it doesn't dominate. So he makes another wine which is all whole bunch, and it's called the Whole Bunch Pinot. But I think with this wine, what he does so well, he does in most of his wines, is it's just a great reflection of what that fruit tastes like. You know, if you taste this fruit when it's just been picked, this is it, you know. And that's what a lot of these winemakers, I think, they get right, is they're not trying to go and turn that flavor and character into some other recipe. They're just trying to show that in the wine, and that's what this does really well. I think all the Cristallum wines do that. That's probably why he's done so well in 10 years, a little bit more than 10 years, but
I love it. I think you've done a really good summary on that, actually. Just the abundance of fruit in the wine, but also this like pure elegant edge to the wine. So it's not over extracted. There's kind of a wood influence in a very subtle, discreet way, and a very pleasant way, and it's just fine. Oh, it's delicious.
I would say that you could put that on the table of any good Pinot Noir, a person that loves a good Pinot Noir. Obviously it's different to Pinot Noir from elsewhere. It's not Burgundy, it's not New Zealand, it's not from Oregon or wherever, but you know, it's got its own character, but it's an incredible wine. Oh, it's nice to also end on something that's quite different to the rest in terms of its classic side to it, but still not boring in any way. It's like also just as drinkable, and like makes you want to drink the whole bottle. It's like that kind of a wine.
No, it really does. It really does. I've almost finished my glass in a matter of minutes.
You did finish your glass.
No, there's still a little bit left. And it wasn't a full glass, in my defense. Now I'm like, don't judge me. Don't judge me. It's because the wine.
I'm just judging you on the pina colada comment.
Yeah. Listen, you can judge me, but I'm very fucking comfortable with that decision and comfortable with my stance towards pina coladas because they're delicious.
That's okay. We've got a nugget on. We're going to do a pina colada pop-up. It's fine. Miami Vice.
I'll come over for it.
Miami Vice. You can do it. You can make the pina coladas.
I'm making pina coladas for all of you. Just so, yeah.
That's exactly what's going to happen.
I won't sing for everybody because they'll run out.
Yeah, we need to have some customers. Just make the drinks. No singing.
So what's the next trend? Is there a grape variety that you think is going to start showing up more in South Africa?
Sure. Semillon has done very well in the last couple of years. I think with Semillon Gris, and so there's more and more of those that have popped up. I think the dry muscats as well. But what I'd like to see, and I guess you are seeing it a bit, but what I would like to see is more of the Spanish and the Portuguese varieties. So there's a handful of them out there, and there's a lot that was planted for port production. So in the last 50 years. So there's a lot of decent old vineyards out there, and they can make some phenomenal wines. Again,
I mean, Tinta Barroca is quite well established, amazing, isn't it? And it works well.
It does. But as we were saying earlier, people don't walk into a wine shop and say, you know, give me your best Tinta Barroca. It just doesn't happen. People walk into the wine shops asking for the popular stuff, you know, the popular classic, you know, grape varieties. So it's obviously a slow process, but for me, those, I'd love it if those varieties, the Tintas and the Tempranillos and the Verdeos and those things started getting more and more popular. I think they grow really well in South Africa. There's some very good versions of them. I don't think there's any exceptionally huge selling versions of them, so it's a very small niche product, but like most of these wines.
Yep.
But I think they've got huge potential. And also, we're talking long-term climate change, all that sort of stuff. They're just well-suited to that. They're adaptable. I mean, South Africa's not a cold place.
Yeah.
It's hot. We should be working with grapes that deal with the heat, and I mean that in itself is a whole podcast. But yeah, it's, I think those grape varieties are great.
I agree. This has been great. So thanks for taking me on a tour through South African wine, South Africa's alternative varieties.
It's a virtual tour. It's not nearly as fun as the real tour.
No, I know. It never is, though, is it? But for people that want to follow what you're doing, how can they find you and all your businesses?
They can easily find us on social media, Instagram, wherever. Just public.
So what's the
public? PUBLIK. That's the key difference. PUBLIK.
So just at public, or is it
at public wine?
At public wine on Instagram and
Facebook and everywhere
and Twitter. Okay, yeah. So at public wine to find you, and the bars are in Cape Town and
Johannesburg
for people that are visiting. So check those out.
Good, and we do lots of tastings and events and that sort of stuff. Just always trying to find ways to expose people to interesting wines and get them to drink different stuff. I mean, that's kind of what our business is based on, is, you know, showcasing all these types of wines to people that are drinking wine but aren't getting the opportunity to find these things.
And for people who live in South Africa that might listen to this podcast the first time that don't know you, which I'm sure
there's millions of them.
I'm sure there's like none of them, but if they want to order wine online, they just put public wine into Google and find you.
They'll find us and they can order.
Okay, cool. Okay, great. Well, that's how to find David, so thank you so much for bringing the wines. Gwen is missing out, and I'm sure she'll be devastated, but I will find her and
share any of these wines with her. You have to just finish them all yourself and then be like, these are the best wines you've ever tried in the whole
So I'll drink series. 6 bottles of wine by myself, mm-hmm. and then I'll phone her and have a conversation with her about it. And we'll
you should record that conversation. You should definitely record it. It'll be amazing.
Yeah. The blooper reel. How to not fall downstairs after 6 bottles of wine.
You should do a blooper reel. You should definitely do that. Just go back on all the podcasts you've done and just like
edit out,
splice out the funny moments of, you know, protests going on in the background, etc. And just throw those into a little mix mash, a little mixtape vibe. It'd be pretty funny.
It would be very funny. So everybody who's tuning in, thanks for tuning in. If you're not subscribed, please do that. That's great. If you want to see videos, this episode is not available on video, but we have many others that are on our YouTube channel, Juice Wine Podcast. Just search for us. And obviously, we want to stay connected via Instagram at juice.podcast. And we're on Twitter at juice_podcast. Gwen usually does all of this stuff, so she's very good at making me not make a mistake. And then we're juice.show is our website. If you want to buy a tote bag or send us an email, our email address is on there. So thanks for tuning in. And until next time, cheers, David.
Cheers. Thank you so much for having me.